Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station we're listening to. It's my views, the views of our guests. And this evening we have with us Professor Thomas Woods, and we're going to be talking about his book, A Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. Professor Woods, thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Dr. Stan, a pleasure to be with you again.
Well, I think your book really has a great message, and certainly we sort of want to go through a couple of the things here, because what you've done is try to challenge some of the things that Americans believe that really aren't true. What motivated you to write the book?
Well, I think you really hit on it right there, as a matter of fact, because there is so much in the standard sort of received version of American history that is either misleading or false that continues to influence public opinion today. It's not just a matter of misunderstanding history. It's that our views of history influence the way we interpret current events. So if we get the history wrong, we're going to tend to interpret current events wrongly as well. And so it's essential that we get the history right from the beginning. And I think that so much of American history has been interpreted and portrayed in ways that, tend to put the government in a more favorable light than perhaps it deserves, and it makes people more inclined to accept government propaganda. So I, in effect, want to rip the mask off of some of this.
Well, I think it's very important because, of course, I hate to be trite, but Santayana, I think, was right when he said that those who cannot remember history are condemned to repeat it. And so let's go through some of the things that you talk about. And you talk about the fact that the American revolutionaries weren't actually conservatives. Most people imagine that the people who created this country well over 200 years ago, almost 230 years ago, were really very conservative in their outlook. And yet, of course, at that time in history, what they were doing was truly very, very liberal. We'll be back in just a moment. Why don't you pick up the story there?
Well, I'm in fact arguing that in major ways, the American revolutionaries were in fact actually conservatives. In the sense that when we think about what is a conservative is somebody who wants to preserve a traditional way of life. We could at least argue that as one definition. And that's what the American revolutionaries were, in effect, trying to do, because their argument was that they've been living and governing themselves really without British interference for about a century and a half until about the 1760s, when the British began insisting on various taxes and regulations and interference in the life of the colonies. And from the colonial point of view, this was bad because this was an innovation. This was something new. The word innovation was not taken as a compliment in those days. That it was bad. That when the government does something that it's never done before, that doesn't belong to its traditional powers, then you're immediately suspect of it. And that was the attitude of the colonists. We want to go back to something that's old. We want our old life back. We want our life of governing ourselves without interference. And that's in effect what they fought for. It was not like the French Revolution, where the French revolutionaries despised the French past. They wanted to start the whole country all over again. They had a calendar starting all over again at the year one. They wanted to get rid of the whole Christian inheritance of France. They hated the French past. They were looking only to the future. Whereas in the American case, Americans loved their past. They embraced it. And that's precisely why they were upset with the British. They felt the British were departing from traditional principles of American self-government. And so the Americans stood up and fought.
Well, I think it's so important that people understand that this was this idea to be maintain a nation where men could be free, because the British tradition was really a freedom with a restriction placed upon the crown by the Magna Carta, the British Bill of Rights, and other things, and then that was being taken away from the American colonists. Is that right?
That's right, and they were the American colonists were incredibly knowledgeable when it came to their liberties and their history. They knew all this stuff. They knew the key documents. They knew the rights that they had. And therefore, they were vigilant, and they were aware when these things were being eroded, and they fought back when they perceived that these things were being eroded. And it's worth noting that that's why the Americans were so careful to have a written constitution. The British didn't have a written constitution. And they thought that because the British lacked a written constitution, it was very hard to pin it down. How do you nail down the British constitution when it's not a single fixed document? So the thinking was that...
Hold that thought there for just a moment,
sure.
Please. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening, Professor Thomas Wood, we're talking about his book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. It's a very, very important book. But anyway, I pick up the story there. You were talking about how the Americans, differentiating with the British, actually wanted a constitution.
Right. They wanted to have a written constitution. The British Constitution was kind of a series of documents, and it was in effect tradition. It was the customary way of doing things was the British Constitution. The problem was pinning it down because it wasn't a document. You couldn't really say, well, the British government is violating Article 7. There is no Article 7. There are no articles. So that was why it was thought so important for Americans to have a written constitution, so that here the U.S. government could be pinned down. You could say, now, wait a minute, this clearly violates this clause of the Constitution. You could be very specific about it. And that's why people like Thomas Jefferson were so careful to say that if we're going to have this written Constitution, we've got to take it seriously. We've got to interpret it the way it's been written. And we can't just let the government get away with saying that, you know, things change and the times change and the Constitution is flexible. As soon as you start saying the Constitution is flexible, you may as well have a blank piece of paper for a Constitution. If you want to change the Constitution, then go right ahead. You can amend the Constitution. But what you should not do is say, well, gee, we'd like the federal government to do X, Y, or Z, but it's not in the Constitution, but let's go ahead and do it anyway. As soon as you start thinking that way, then... as Jefferson would say, you may as well have a blank piece of paper for a constitution.
And, of course, this is one of our concerns about what's going on today. We see in the name of expediency, well, my goodness, we're involved in a war with terrorism. We've just got to take away this freedom, that freedom, and another freedom, because after all, how are we going to be able to protect the freedom of the people if we don't take away freedoms? And once you begin to vary from that written constitution, why, you're just opening Pandora's box, and you'll never get Pandora back in again.
Yeah, that's a big problem, and I think the fact that clearly the American experience with the Constitution has not, in the year 2006, I think we can say, has not been successful, because obviously the U.S. government is not exactly the limited institution scrupulously confining itself to its enumerated powers that the Founding Fathers hoped it would be. I mean, there's no question about that. And I think given this failure, given that we have this government that every one of the framers would have been shocked to observe, I think we need to be prepared to ask serious and fundamental questions and not be afraid of drawing radical conclusions. When we remember what Thomas Jefferson said as far back as 1798, Jefferson said that it's not enough to have a written constitution because you have to enforce a constitution. Constitutions are just pieces of paper. They don't enforce themselves. And the danger that Jefferson perceived was, how are you going to have a limited government kept limited by a constitution if the very government you're limiting by the constitution gets to interpret the constitution? I mean, imagine that. The very institution that's supposed to be limited by the constitution is the same institution that interprets that document. Well, naturally, it's going to interpret the document in its own favor. It's going to interpret it broadly, and it's going to interpret it as affording itself broad powers. And so Jefferson took the radical position in 1798 in his Kentucky resolutions that the states, if they believed the federal government had violated the Constitution, had the right to refuse to enforce a federal law that they believed violated the Constitution. And Jefferson said, this way, it might actually stay limited, because instead of the federal government being the only institution that can interpret the Constitution, now the states can interpret it. And the states can say, no, we refuse. We refuse to go along with this particular act because we absolutely insist that it violates our founding document. Well, then maybe you might have some chance. But today, that idea would be, not very popular. We'll just put it that way.
Well,
but I don't see any other way.
No, you're absolutely right. That's because today most Americans don't understand our Constitution, don't understand why it was written as it was, and certainly don't understand of the fear that our founding fathers had of giving men power over other men.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, Jefferson, above all, was extremely skeptical of human nature. And of course, in fact, that's why not only did he want to do what the other framers wanted, which was to break power up into three branches, executive, legislative, and judicial, but he also wanted to break power up into the different states. And then within the states, he didn't want the state government to be too powerful. He wanted counties to have power, and cities, and even wards, just a part of a city. He wanted power to be as broken up into little bits as he could get it, and he wanted it to be as close to the people as possible, because occasionally you can beat City Hall, but it's extremely difficult to beat Washington, D.C.
Amen to that. Well, let's get on to some of the other things that I agree with. I think this is such an important issue that people have to understand that our founding fathers feared government. And somebody once said, when the government fears the people, there's freedom, but when the people fear the government, there is soon tyranny. Well, you talk here about something about Franklin Delano Roosevelt agreed to send 1 million Russian POWs back to Stalin. What was that all about?
Oh, right. This is both Franklin Roosevelt and then later Harry Truman. As World War II was drawing to a close, of course, throughout the war, Franklin Roosevelt had cultivated a very warm relationship with Joseph Stalin. Stalin, by the way, when he was a young man, had reluctantly gone to an Orthodox Christian seminary to train as a priest. His heart was never in it, and he left. But Franklin Roosevelt at one point said that he believed that some of Stalin's seminary training had rubbed off on him because he was such a gentleman. I mean, that statement alone is almost an unbelievable obscenity, but that was about Roosevelt's assessment of Stalin, that he was sort of affable and friendly and a good ruler and a great man, and so he had a certain confidence in Stalin. Well, it so happens that during World War II, a great many Russians, in effect, did an early form of defecting. They simply went over to the other side. They wanted, and they began to fight against Stalin, because they thought, here's our great opportunity to get this crazed mass murderer out of power. And so Stalin came to the conclusion that he wanted to get his hands on some of these Russian POWs, because he thought some of them had deliberately gone over to the other side. He didn't know which ones had done it exactly, so he would just, in effect, liquidate them all. So, in effect, when the war was over, by the time the war was over, Franklin Roosevelt had already worked out an arrangement with Stalin whereby there would be prisoner of war exchanges and that sort of thing. But the difference is the Russian POWs did not want to go back to Russia because they didn't know what Stalin had in store for them. Was he going to work them to death? Was he going to kill them all? Either because he resented that they were bad soldiers or he resented that they may have actually turned against him. They did not want to go back. I mean, some of these people committed suicide rather than go back. And it was called Operation Keelhaul, whereby Roosevelt and then later Truman took part in turning over at least 1 million men against their will, turning them back over to Stalin. They begged not to be returned to him because they knew they would be killed. But they did this, in effect, to ingratiate themselves into Stalin's favor and to continue the friendship with him. And it was horrific because even on American soil, in Fort Dix, New Jersey, you had hundreds of Russian prisoners of war begging, hundreds of Russian soldiers begging not to be returned back to Russia. But they were returned. And in fact, to return them, they had to be drugged and some of them beaten because they were so desperate to stay away from Soviet Russia because they were terrified of Stalin while they were sent back. And it was a horrific episode about which most of the necessary documents to know more about it are still classified. So we know relatively little other than it was a horrific thing that European reporters observed and wrote about. But it's not really in your typical American history textbook, because that would maybe cast Roosevelt and Truman in a negative light. And you see, the experts who govern us have already told us that Roosevelt and Truman were capital G, capital P, great presidents.
In fact, we actually have a program that was on television, on BBC, shown in America only one time, goes into Operation Keel Haul. That is one of the most heartrending stories, and the fact that these people were here in America and didn't want to be sent back to be killed, and most of them were killed, certainly, or worked to death in the Siberia. The fact that that took place, and few Americans understand that, simply is a reflection of the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think.
Right, exactly. I mean, this is information that, as I say, although some of the sources we might like to read aren't available, the basic outline of what happened is as clear as day and just waiting to be uncovered by somebody. But it just so happens that, as you say, Dr. Stan, by some odd coincidence, it just never gets mentioned or it's just not raised. Anything that would cast the political class in a potentially negative light, and in fact, in a case like this, it would make them complicit in mass murder, well, it's just going to be passed over and we just go on to the next thing.
Well, you have something here about the war on poverty actually made poverty worse. That's it's an idea which is so foreign to our way of thinking, and yet it really is true. Would you like to get into the war on poverty that was supposedly going to help all the impoverished people of America?
Oh, sure. I mean, in fact, it turns out that we've now spent the money we've spent on the war on poverty. You could pretty much buy all the Fortune 500 companies, and you'd still have enough money left over to buy all the farmland in America, and then still more things after that. And poverty has more or less stayed the same or increased slightly. It seems that from about 1950 to 1968, poverty was going down by about a percentage point per year without much poverty program at all. Then you start throwing money at it, and it stagnates. I think we're coming up to a break, are we?
I think we are. You just hang on there. We'll be back in just a moment. Our guest is Professor Thomas Woods. His book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. We carry the book. We think it's a great book. And we'll be back in just a moment with Professor Woods. Okay, pick up the story there. Is there anything else you'd like to say at all about the war on poverty? Sort of like the war on cancer, we have more cancer, the war on drugs, we seem to have more drugs, and certainly the war on terrorism. Boy, we got a lot more terrorism than we had before.
Yeah, well, there's no. It seems that every time these war metaphors are used, it's always a disaster. I remember when Jimmy Carter said that the energy crisis was the moral equivalent of war. They always want to use this war imagery. Unfortunately for Carter, moral equivalent of war spelled meow. So, unfortunately for him. But with the case of the war on poverty, I mean, I don't mean to be self-serving here, but you'd sort of need to look at the book. But the argument that I make is one that a number of social scientists have made, is that the way these poverty programs were designed is that they in effect rewarded the very conditions that they sought to alleviate. So obviously, yes, if you say we're going to give more money to people who are unmarried and having children out of wedlock, well, it so happens you're going to get more of that. If you subsidize something, you're going to get more of it. And the welfare culture that was created by these programs has in effect created a whole subset of the American population that is utterly incapable of caring for itself or behaving responsibly. We get to a point, as I say, where the most incredibly destructive human behavior is being positively encouraged by these programs, and you don't see people working their way out of poverty by them. What you see is year after year after year, people getting in effect more and more trapped in this welfare trap. I mean, I have to admit that in the 90s, under conservative pressure, to be sure, Bill Clinton, I actually will say, did actually do a good thing when he he in effect abolished the AFDC program, replaced it with something else that was more temporary and more geared toward the states. But even that, even the AFDC program, that's only about 6% of all the welfare programs we have. And when Clinton, you know, abolished this one program, he said we are ending welfare as we know it. Okay, so he abolishes 6% of a complete failure. That's not exactly ending welfare as we know it. It has been a complete catastrophe. And we're not talking about people who are really desperate and, you know, what are you going to do when somebody's desperate and starving? You've got to help them in some way, I suppose. But we're talking about a system that created dependency. We're talking about a system in which, at one point in the 70s, it was almost 10% of the population was on food stamps. There were more people on welfare in New York City alone than the populations of 15 states in the Union. I mean, the liberalism in these programs encouraged people, in effect, especially when you got a minimum wage job or a low wage job, after a while, the more generous the welfare payments become, the stupider you feel working. And that's a very, very dangerous path to go down, because most people naturally don't feel like working. Most of us would rather sit around all day. We don't have to be encouraged to sit around all day. We have to be encouraged to work. But when we have every incentive in the world, government programs, the culture, telling us that we shouldn't have to, or this or that job is beneath us, then you never take the first steps on that ladder to success. And you wind up, in effect, one of these unfortunate welfare cases. This has not helped anybody. Sometimes it really is cruel to be kind.
Hold that thought for just a moment. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're talking about the welfare programs that really did far more harm than good. We had, certainly a black underclass in America, but it was a strong families, and the blacks were really improving themselves and really getting ahead, moving up into the middle class. And once we got the welfare program, and you couldn't get any money unless the man left the home. Today, and still, we have the residual where 75% of black children are born out of wedlock. You did not see that before the government came in to help the black family and ended up really destroying it.
Yeah, that's right. In effect, the government is trying to take the place of a husband and take the place of family members, and the results are all around us. I mean, there's no way you can look at the inner cities and say this is a wonderful example of success, or look at, I remember, in fact, John Kenneth Galbraith, who was the not quite socialist, but very, very, very liberal economist who recently died, who said in the 60s that there's nothing wrong with New York City that doubling the city budget wouldn't solve. Well, they tripled the city budget. And if you looked at the state of New York City under Mayor David Dinkins, for example, I just don't see how you can still be conscious, have a pulse, look around and think that what we need is just another tripling of the budget. I just can't possibly believe that. Take a quick stroll through an inner city school. Just take a stroll, just look around at what you see in the hallways, just take a peek into the classrooms and ask yourself, is the problem here money? I mean, is that really, or is it the problem that they don't have enough computers in this school? The problems here are far more fundamental and are not quite so easily solved by some government program designed by some Harvard graduate somewhere.
Amen to that. In fact, you're teaching, I don't know, I've heard from many of the teachers who've been in the profession for, 30 or 40 years, that they've just noticed the overall quality of our students going down. In other words, the ones that are coming into college now are certainly not as well prepared or capable as they were 30 years ago.
It's quite shocking. I mean, for 7 years I taught in the State University of New York system, and it was sad. I mean, it's partly not their fault. It's partly the educational system itself. But these are, by the time you get to age 18, these are adults. They should be taking responsibility for their education. Their parents should be aware of what they're learning or what they're not learning. And it's to the point where I have a friend who's an economist who says that in the old days, he'd get freshman students, and he'd have to start off his class by by answering all the economic myths that they had come to believe. He says now the caliber of student is so poor that they don't even know the economic myths. So he has to explain the myths and then answer the myths.
Well, of course, that takes us on to another subject, and that is, of course, that the Franklin Roosevelt's administration got us out of the Great Depression and brought prosperity to the country. Now, there's a great myth.
Well, this one, it's absolutely staggering that people are going through school being taught that Franklin Roosevelt rescued the country from the Depression. Now, sometimes you can get a historian to concede that, okay, Franklin Roosevelt's programs in the 30s did not succeed in getting us out of the Depression, but then they'll fall back on something like, you know, but he gave us hope. He gave everybody hope. I mean, they'll come up with some platitude like this. He gave everybody hope. So in other words, the unemployment rate averages 18% from 1933 to 1940, but don't worry because he's giving us hope. Well, I mean, I just don't see that giving us hope is something to celebrate. I mean, if you're caught at the bottom of a well and a guy is yelling to you, I'm going to get a ladder, the guy with the ladder is almost here, the ladder's just about here, and there is no ladder, yeah, he's giving you hope, but is he doing you any good? I mean, what's the point? And so what I'm showing in my book is that modern-day economists are more and more looking at the record of the 1930s and saying, not only did Franklin Roosevelt not lift the country out of the Depression, but it seems quite likely that the Depression became substantially worse than it would otherwise have been because of Franklin Roosevelt's programs. Everything from the National Recovery Administration, which cut down on production at a time when, you know, the country obviously needs more production, that was raising wages to the point where people were being made unemployable. And so you had millions and millions and millions of people out of work. In fact, in the early 30s, prices were falling dramatically at a time that Roosevelt's raising wages. That's just not a combination for prosperity. It can't work.
I remember, of course, I'm old enough to remember during the time when, of course, there was a shortage of food, and yet they were, taking potato crops and pouring purple dye over it and burying the food to drive the prices of the food up.
That's right. They're slaughtering pigs, too, yeah.
We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Professor Thomas Woods. We're talking about his book, published by Regnery, called The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. Fascinating book. It's a sort of book that every college student should read, hopefully, to realize that much of what they've been taught just isn't true. We were talking about President Roosevelt and all of his socialist schemes to get America out of the Great Depression. And instead of really getting us out of the Depression, he got us into a worse and worse situation. In fact, if it hadn't been for the Second World War, why, we never would have gotten out of the recession. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Well, in fact, I even take the position that World War II, although obviously production increased for military purposes, even this kind of concealed the fact that, as far as the American consumer was concerned, World War II was still not a return to the prosperity of the 20s. Because, yes, it's true, unemployment did go down dramatically during World War II, but a lot of that had to do with the fact that, you know, millions of men have just been conscripted into the armed forces. So, naturally, unemployment goes down. But the fact is that, you know, during the war, of course, you couldn't buy new homes, cars, appliances. A lot of things were being rationed, or you couldn't get them at all. So you were piling up a lot of unspendable income. So yes, a lot of stuff was being produced, bombs and planes and tanks, but those aren't things that consumers use. So people were being taxed to fund things that they can't themselves use. And they now have less money with which to buy fewer goods because the economy is being devoted to military production rather than consumer production. So from the point of view of consumer well-being, since I can't eat a tank, I can't live in it, I can't use it for anything, that doesn't actually, it may make the GNP figures go up, but it doesn't actually help my well-being. So actually, the real prosperity finally was restored after the war. If you look at the year 1946, it's a fantastic year economically. If you read the newspapers, people are thrilled. They're doing great. They're not getting shot at anymore. They're not going to get killed. It's a wonderful time. And because, in effect, finally, normal conditions are being restored. There's no more New Deal. There's no more president who seems like he's going to do some crazy thing every other week. And so businesses had been reluctant to invest throughout the 30s because they didn't know if their investments were safe under Roosevelt. But after the New Deal was all through and spent itself and the war was all over and normal conditions returned, the American economy had the single greatest year it has ever had in terms of private production, ever. So just give us normal conditions and the sky is the limit.
Well, hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment here with Professor Thomas Wood. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were just talking about how really it wasn't President Roosevelt that got us out of the war. It was after he was out of office, and, of course, he had the opportunity to get back to a free enterprise system, why, of course, America did begin to flourish. And of course, the trouble was that the rest of the world was just devastated, and America had the productive capacity and began supplying not only goods for ourselves, but goods for the rest of the world. And this was really one of the great economic miracles of all time. America, suddenly the dominant, we were making probably 50% of all the goods that were being manufactured in the world there for a period of time immediately after the Second World War.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, what's interesting is that even by the end of the 1920s, well before the war, already the U.S. was producing about one-third of all the production in the whole world. Just in the 20s, before the U.S. was even considered to be the major, major power that it became after World War II. And that's in large part because in the 1920s you had a super free economy. You didn't have all kinds of government burdens. At one point in 1926, the unemployment rate hit 1%. I mean, it's unheard of. And the result was an explosion in prosperity. So in effect, there may be a lesson here. The 20s, you had a couple of caretaker presidents, Harding and Coolidge, whom the historians hate, by the way, and you had fantastic prosperity. Then you have the Franklin Roosevelts of the world, you know, who are going to improve us and initiate all these new programs, and their record is absolutely appalling. But those are the ones we're supposed to cheer. We're supposed to hate Harding and Coolidge. In my opinion, every time one of those polls comes out every few years or so, where the historians are polled and they rank all the presidents in terms of which ones are the great presidents, which ones are the not so great, whatever, I always think that in fact these lists should be turned upside down, and you know the ones the historians hate are actually almost always the best presidents. You know the ones they love are actually catastrophic and terrible. You know, so pretty much you can't go wrong by coming up with an assessment that's the exact opposite of theirs.
In fact, the story of Calvin Coolidge, I remember reading about him, studying about him when I was in college, and he was known as Silent Cal. He just never said anything, and the idea that he was sort of stupid and that he's stodgy and not a very likable person, and yet he was probably one of our greatest presidents because he didn't want the government interfering in the lives of the people. He wanted the people to be free, because that's how you got your major production and advancement.
That's right. In fact, he said there's always a great temptation to spend the public money because it doesn't seem to belong to anyone. You know, so there's a great temptation to go spend it. So I love Calvin Coolidge. I think he was kind of funny in his own way, he has a fantastic record to show for it. I hope you won't mind, Dr. Stan, if I just pause and note, I'm not required to do this by my publisher, Regnery, but I thought people might be interested to know that after my book, Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, came out, you know, it did pretty well, Regnery decided they're going to do a whole series of books on this sort of, with this title, like the Politically Incorrect Guide to blank. And so they've done a Politically Incorrect Guide to Science by Tom Bethel, and they've done a Politically Incorrect Guide to English and American Literature, which just came out. They've done one on Darwinism and intelligent design, and I love this idea. I didn't come up with it. They came up with the idea of politically incorrect guides, but to me, the sky's the limit here. There's so many subjects that can be covered in these, and every single one of them drives the establishment crazy because they're easy to read, you know, they're cheap, a lot of people can pick them up, and just after a few hours of reading, you can really be brought up to speed on kind of a, you know, a reliable and accurate overview of a whole area. So I think it's wonderful, and I hope we get 50 of these over the next few years. It's great for school kids. They can inoculate them against what they're going to be propagandized into when they get to college.
Well, actually, we've done a Tom Bethel on science, politically incorrect science, and so we've got Guide to Science.
And we have
a copy of the one on Darwin. We're going to read that, and certainly I'd like to get the author of that.
Oh, wonderful.
It.
Good.
Let's talk a little bit about this. Hundreds of American liberals had secret ties to the Soviets. Now, of course, this sounds like the McCarthyism, you know, Joe McCarthy making these ridiculous statements about all these Soviets and Soviet sympathizers and communists, you know, who are working in our government. The trouble is, he was absolutely right. There were a lot of communists working on our government. Would you like to go ahead and pick up that story?
Well, here's one of the great sort of non-stories of the past 15 years, I would say, because when it became clear in the mid-1990s, thanks to recently declassified intelligence information, that in fact there were at least hundreds of Americans who had direct ties to the Soviet Union and were in fact engaged in either in espionage or in some kind of assistance with the Soviet Union. When that became public and it really was pretty much undeniable because of the so-called Venona decrypts, which were in the 1940s, there was a brief Soviet intelligence vulnerability, and we were able to intercept a lot of their messages. Now, it's taken a long time to decode them. We still only decoded a small fraction of them, but thanks to those, we figured out that there are at least several hundred, and I'm sure if we decoded them all, we'd find perhaps thousands of people. You'd think this would be a huge story, right? I mean, all of a sudden in the 1990s, it becomes clear that, yes, it turns out that this really was a problem of espionage. I mean, suppose the story had been that during World War II, there were all these Nazis in the U.S. government, secretly, little did we know. You know, that'd be all over the papers, right? You'd never hear the end of it. This came out, pretty much no response at all. Was there a New York Times article on it? If so, I don't remember it. Did the Washington Post cover it? If so, I don't remember. Did Dan Rather mention it? No mention at all. Not a single word. And yet there it is for the whole world to see. I mean, what more evidence do we need? You know, that the media is filtering the news. I mean, there it is.
And, of course, I think what's so interesting is they were working right in the White House itself, and certainly the closest advisors, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Harry Hopkins, was looked upon by the Soviets as an asset of theirs.
Well, that's right. And then you had Harry Dexter White in the Treasury Department. You had Alger Hiss. And, I mean, if you look at the number of people who were in one way or another involved with the U.N. in the early years, Americans at the UN, that was infested with communists. It's a serious problem. And part of the reason the left can't take this seriously is that a lot of people on the left still have this kind of romantic view of communists, that they're just kind of liberals in a hurry. You know, they just want what's best for everybody. And so they just can't get themselves worked up about the problem of communist infiltration. But, you know, it was a problem, and I don't think that these were just liberals in a hurry, because most liberals probably don't want to engage in mass murder, but that's what these guys did.
You're absolutely right, and the great tragedy is that the American people are not being told the truth. Every opportunity is taken to defame Joe McCarthy, Senator McCarthy, and he may not have been perfect, but who among us is? But I think he was really trying to expose the communist influence in our government, and of course had his career destroyed because of it.
That's right. In fact, by the end of this year, I believe that the release date is December, Stan Evans, who's one of the great conservatives, who's somehow managed to live in D.C. and not become corrupted, but Stan Evans has written a book on, he spent, I believe, about 10 years researching this, the definitive book on McCarthy. It's available on Amazon for pre-order. It's called Blacklisted by History, and it's a history of Joe McCarthy, written by Stan Evans, and from what I understand, it is probably the most systematic defense of McCarthy that's ever been written. So I think it'll be, it'll be fun to see what the media reaction is, although I can predict what it'll be. It won't necessarily be negative. It'll be simply to ignore it. That's the media's big weapon, is the power to ignore. And that's one of the beautiful equalizing factors introduced by the Internet, because the media can ignore it, but people will still go out and buy it if they find out about it on the Internet. So it's so wonderful to be able to do an end run around the big media these days.
It really is exciting. Well, I'd like to take another issue here, because you approach this whole idea of discrimination against the blacks and how it really was this wonderful civil rights legislation that has helped the blacks to have a better life in America. And you say that this really is not true. So give us the real truth about this civil rights legislation and really what it's done more to destroy the blacks in this country than anything else.
Well, this will seem surprising because, of course, we've all been led to believe that, you know, without the Civil Rights Act of 1964, there wouldn't be a black middle class, there wouldn't be black economic progress, and so on and so forth. This is a myth. And it's provably a myth, by the way, based on the statistics that I make available in the book. This is a myth that has been cultivated by the black establishment because they want blacks to believe that government and black activists are what have made their prosperity possible. They want them to go through life thinking that, so that the donations will keep coming in and these black organizations and Jesse Jackson, you know, won't have to get a real job. And they can spend the rest of their lives advocating more and more and more programs like this. But the fact is that black economic progress had been much greater in the 1940s and 50s before there really was much of a civil rights movement or before it was really getting going, much, much more progress then than there was in the 1960s. There was much more progress in terms of wages and in terms of black representation in management and white-collar jobs and professional jobs, much more of that in the 1 year before the Civil Rights Act than there were in the 2 years following the Civil Rights Act. The Civil Rights Act did not accelerate trends in black employment that were already at work. Same thing was true for Hispanics. Same thing was true for Asian Americans. Japanese Americans, for example, just simply made progress over the years without the help of any government. The Japanese Americans, of course, during World War II, many of them were interned, so you would think, you know, in camps, so you would think they would use that as an excuse and say, well, of course we're not going to prosper. I mean, look at how we suffered during World War II. They didn't use that as an excuse. By 1959, they had equaled whites in income, and by 1969, Japanese Americans were earning one-third more. Excuse me. So these statistics do not match up with what we've been taught, which is that, you know, that America is a racist society, and without special government favors, non-whites are simply not going to prosper. You just cannot sustain that argument.
And of course, really, many of our states, the individual states, had anti-discrimination laws, and I think that they're with good reason for it. But when the federal government came in and certainly began to use federal force and violate our Constitution, allow ever more power to be centralized in the federal government, they didn't solve the problem. They actually accelerated it in many parts of the country. So I think this is, people have to understand that this was a total and flagrant violation of the various concepts of our Constitution. Nobody's in favor of discrimination, but a federal solution oftentimes makes things far worse than they were before.
Yeah, because now you have a gigantic, clumsy bureaucracy trying to oversee the employment practices of every company in America, all of which now are terrified about making employment decisions because half the time they could be government stooges applying for the positions just to see if they're going to discriminate or not. I mean, this is, you know, what is this, the Soviet Union?
Well, I fear that in many respects we're sort of moving in that direction today. Now, with a massive bureaucracy that can control almost anything and everybody's property here in the United States under the Environmental Protection Act or some other stupid thing or certainly fighting terrorism or certainly the IRS going after people who are political enemies of the administration. I don't think it can't happen here. Well, right. Now, Cindy, let's talk a little bit about the Civil War, because I think that's such an important story, and certainly Lincoln's attitude towards the Civil War. What was the Civil War really fought about? Was the Civil War really fought about slavery?
I think there is a role for slavery in the war, because I do think that some Southern states made clear that, you know, that the slavery issue, it does in fact account for why we're seceding. But that's not true of all the Southern states. There were four Southern states, including Virginia, North Carolina, Arkansas, that seceded only after Lincoln had decided to use force on the original seceding Southern states. So those states didn't secede over slavery. They seceded because they believed that Lincoln was embarked on a mad project of using coercion against the American states that was totally at odds with the idea of a voluntary American Union of states that had voluntarily joined. Lincoln made perfectly clear, at least in the first 18 months of the war, that the desire to abolish slavery was not what was animating the war. In fact, he basically made clear to the South that if you stay in the Union, you pay your taxes, you can keep your slaves. He said that he favored a constitutional amendment that would have forever prevented the federal government from ever interfering with slavery in the future, if that's what it would take to keep the Southern states in the Union. The Senate passed a resolution saying that the only purpose of this war is to keep the Union together. It is not to interfere in the institutions of the states, by which they obviously meant slavery. This was known to everybody. It was a desire simply to keep the Union together. And now I don't take the Hitler argument lightly. I don't like to say that somebody who disagrees with me necessarily agrees with Hitler, but it is worth noting that in Hitler's book Mein Kampf, if you actually look at what does Hitler say about the U.S. Civil War, what's absolutely fascinating and totally overlooked is that Hitler's a huge fan of Lincoln. He loves Lincoln because Lincoln is doing exactly what Hitler wanted to do in Germany, which is he is fighting against states' rights and he's holding together a great big white country. And he's not allowing secession. Well, that's exactly what Hitler wanted to do in Germany. He hated states' rights in Germany. Why? Because they were an obstacle to his consolidation of power. The idea that these states should have rights of their own or be able to resist the central government was unthinkable to a nationalist like Hitler. And so he despised the Southern cause, and he cheered on Lincoln. Now, that doesn't make Lincoln automatically wrong, and I'm not saying Lincoln is Hitler. That would be ridiculous, but I do think that that's an interesting perspective to consider, that a totalitarian, one of the worst totalitarians of all time, looking at this, sides with the war for the Union rather than the cause of secession.
And, of course, really, I think really the great, great tragedy is that, you know, the emancipation occupation did not free the slaves in the North. Where, of course, he had the ability to free them. It freed the slaves in the South, where they didn't have the ability to free them.
Right.
And, you know, most people really don't understand. They passed the Emancipation Proclamation because they had to have something to rally the people behind the government. It's the oldest game in the world, isn't it?
You got it.
We're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program. Incidentally, we carry the book. Do you have a website you wanted to get out there?
Sure, it's thomasewoods.com.
thomasewoods.com, and I'm sure there's a great deal of great information there, and of course we'll tell you a little bit later about the book. It is available through Radio Liberty. It's called The Politically Incorrect American History. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. All right, well, perhaps we can just finish off the program. We've got about 3 minutes of talking about the Civil War and its aftermath. Professor Wood?
Yes.
We've got about 3 minutes, and would you like to just go ahead and tell us about the Civil War and its aftermath?
Oh, sure. Well, 3 minutes. Let's see. This will be a world record.
go ahead.
I think the significant thing that people should bear in mind about it, if there's just one thing they remember about it, it's that the nature of the United States changed. Something really significant happened there, and it wasn't just the freeing of the slaves, which is something that we can all certainly cheer, but something really happened. Something died in America in 1865, And in some ways, it's an older America that had many virtues. It's the America of Thomas Jefferson, where you had individual states, each of which had powers and rights of their own, and that could, in an emergency, as a last resort, stand up to the federal government and say no. They could say, no, we're not going to enforce this law, and in a very last resort, they could say, no, we're not going to be in this union anymore. And it had a good effect on the federal government. It kept the federal government in line, because that government knew that the states had powers to resist. After the Civil War, a lot of people came to the conclusion that Lincoln's view of the Union, where the United States is just one big whole, you know, it's one whole, it's one big whole, it was thought that that version of American history had won on the battlefield, and that to talk about states' rights and secession or anything like that was kind of old hat and old-fashioned after 1865. And so we have no right to be surprised when the federal government just runs roughshod over states and communities and neighborhoods, because there is no restraint on its power anymore. The states used to be that restraint, but they were basically emasculated by the war and in the wake of the war. And ever since then, we've been taught to cheer this as a wonderful move toward progress. We have in our Pledge of Allegiance that the nation is one and indivisible. But that was not the way Jefferson thought of things, that what was much more important than the Union was liberty, and that, yes, you should be able to use those states as resistance mechanisms against the federal government. Unfortunately, that is the America that died in 1865, and that wasn't just a stupid, reactionary America. That was a good and decent America that did manage to keep limited government for a long time. So there may be a lesson in there somewhere.
Well, God bless you. Thanks very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you here with us at Radio Liberty.
Likewise, Dr. Stan. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Good night.
Good night.
All right. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed our interview with Professor Wood. I always enjoy it. And, of course, in the South, they still refer to the Civil War as the War of Northern Aggression. And they've never forgiven the North for what they did when the South invaded the North. They treated the civilians, the private property, you know, with respect. They didn't burn or destroy or pillage. But when the North under Lincoln invaded the South, they burned everything, you know, as Sherman marched to the sea. So a war is a terrible thing, and as Sherman said, war is hell. There's nothing of redemption about it. And this is some lesson I wish that they knew in Washington, D.C. today. Well, be that as it may, this is the time I just want to mention we do carry the book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. And there's so much about American history you need to know. We actually have something called the Founding Documents. And they're all the founding documents of America, from the Mayflower Compact to Lincoln's Farewell Address and the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. And there are 50 documents there. You need to have them. And they were put together by our good friend Chuck Baldwin, Pastor Chuck Baldwin. And they're available from Radio Liberty. If you'd like to know more, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Now, when we talk about Joe McCarthy, we have to understand Senator McCarthy recognized there was a subversive element in government. What he did not understand is that they were there as a cover, because it was not the communists who were working in government who were responsible for the betrayal of Eastern Europe and of China to the communists in the hands of the communists after the Second World War. It was the people in the Council on Foreign Relations, financed by the great tax-exempt foundations and this elite group we refer to as the CFR and the Trilateral Commission, these people who have financed communism since its inception. So we would have the best enemy money could buy, so we could rally the people behind the government as we moved from freedom to fascism to the destruction of America. If you'd like to know more about that, of course, you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to get Professor Sutton's book about Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, going into how we financed the Bolshevik, Wall Street and the rise of Hitler, how we financed Adolf Hitler. You of course, need to get the Best Enemies Money Could Buy video, my interview with Professor Sutton before he passed away. the best enemies money could buy video. It's an excellent video. And, of course, the book, we still have a few copies of that. But when they're gone, why they're gone, they won't be available anymore. What most people did not understand, and even Professor Sutton, for whom I had the greatest respect, did not understand, is the spiritual forces that energize these people. What is their goal? They want to create a world government and destroy Christianity because these people worship a different God. What are we talking about? Well, you need to see, of course, the video of the secret mysteries of America's beginning, and I have a small part in that. The secret mysteries of America's beginning, the Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2 videos. We have the Sold Their Souls for rock and roll videos. We have four tape sets on the supernatural, on Satanism and deliverance. We have Malachi Martin's interviews, and at least one of them, he talks about Satanism and the Catholic Church. But I'm not picking on the Catholics. It's alive and well in the Jewish Church. It's alive and well in the Protestant Church today. You must understand we're involved in a spiritual battle, being fought on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield. If you certainly do not subscribe to the Radio Liberty newsletter, which you may if you'd like to, give us a call. We'd be glad to send you a free copy of either our August or September newsletter. But if you have access to the Internet, you can go up on the Internet and you can pull those down and read my September and October newsletters. August and September newsletters, if you really want to understand what happened on the 11th of September, 2001. And then, of course, we have some great new videos, Terror Storm, 911, Press for the Truth. You need to get the information. You need to help us disseminate the truth. And then pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection, because we're on the front lines of this battle. If you can help us, we'd sure appreciate it. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station we're listening to. It's my views, the views of our guests. And this hour, we're going to have with us Glenn Spencer from the American Patrol or the American Border Patrol. And Glenn is one of those unusual people who's, has been selected, I believe probably chosen by our Lord to be involved in this battle. And his, of course, interest, his sphere of influence is trying to tell the American people about the fact that our country is being invaded. Now, of course, everybody knows about the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and our boys are over there fighting for freedom. But while our boys are over there fighting for freedom, in a war that we're not being allowed to win, I mean, they've never given adequate numbers of troops, American troops, to really, of course, bring peace to Iraq or Afghanistan. And, of course, we're not doing anything we can't possible to get the Iraqi army trained and ready to take over. And it'll be 10 or 20 years before the Iraqi army, which we've intentionally organized in such a manner that could never be effective because we want an excuse to stay there. So all our boys are fighting overseas while we're, of course, being invaded here at home. Now you're told that there are about 11 million illegals here. The figure varies between 20 and 30 million, and certainly in Dr. Jerome Corsi's latest book. Why, he and Jim Kilchrist, who wrote the book, The Minuteman, say there may be as many as 30 million illegal immigrants in the United States today, and they're flooding across our border because the government has intentionally not tried to enforce our laws. They've steadfastly refused to build a fence. They have had a program known as catch and release, and so if you have people, and for an example would be somebody, a Muslim from a terrorist nation, and they're apprehended coming into our country illegally, what happens? Why, they're called in, they're arrested, they're told to come back in a month or two for a deportation hearing, and you'd never guess what happens. The majority of these people who have violated our laws don't come back for the hearing to be deported. I wonder why not. I guess they just don't understand our laws. Well, I mean, the things that are going on just don't make any sense, but Glenn Spencer is down there on the front lines of the battle, and let's get brought up to date. Glenn, do they still have the catch and release program, or are they doing that any differently now?
Well, they say they've stopped it. However, the evidence is they have not.
Oh, I mean, certainly George Bush has been in office for 5 years, and they've kept the catch-and-release program up just before the upcoming election because they're going to try to look good for the American people, because they can't let the American people know that their loyalty is not to America but to this internationalist dream.
Well, you're absolutely right, Dr. Stan. I've been at this for 15 years, full-time, 7 days a week watching this. I am trained as an economist and a mathematician. I am trained to look at data, to analyze things and make conclusions. And I was having dinner the other night, and I said, you know, I not only worked as a I worked my way through college working with scientists. Dr. Eugene Tikhachenko, a good friend of mine, I work with scientists, and I said that the one thing about a scientist is the worst thing that they could happen to them is if they were caught cheating on a scientific paper, that they had published some research they had done, and they had been found not telling the truth. They would be ruined for life.
Hold that. We'll be back here in just a moment with Glenn Spencer of American Patrol. Well, Glenn, you were talking about Sydney, the thing that would be the worst thing for a scientist would be to be caught cheating or lying and, of course, losing their scientific integrity. So pick the story up.
That is correct. And they would be ruined for life. And yet today we have people who are elected to office who lie to us regularly, dissemble the truth, lie, and yet nothing happens to them. But it does happen to us. That the fact is that we are being invaded across our borders, and the President of the United States, not just this one but others, have lied to us, and they continue to lie to us. So I live here right on the border, Pakistan. As you know, I'm 1,000 feet north of the Mexican border in one of the heaviest smuggling areas in the United States. In fact, just a little while ago, I was out with a Border Patrol agent about 50 feet from where I am right now, helping him chase down a group of people who just invaded our country.
Well, did he catch him or not?
No, he didn't. We couldn't find him.
Yeah, and of course, how do they feel about the fact that there's a couple of the border patrolmen have been sentenced to 10 or 12 years in jail because, of course, they shot an armed suspect who was fleeing from them?
Well, they feel terrible. But it starts at the very head of our country. I don't want to get too complicated, but I saw this in January of 2001, a week after the president was inaugurated. He said, we've got to make migration safe and orderly.
Now, not immigration or illegal migration, but migration.
And I knew that legal immigration was already safe and orderly. So he had to be talking about illegal immigration. So when those two officers were involved in a difficulty at the border, they were not making it safe and orderly for the drug smugglers. They were not making it safe and orderly for those who are invading our country. That's why they were prosecuted, because they violated the guidelines set up by the President of the United States 5 years ago.
All right, hang on to that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Glenn Spencer talking about illegal immigration. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is Glenn Spencer of Border Patrol, American Border Patrol. And Glenn, certainly we have, of course, been told that now, of course, that they have, they're really much more efficient. We've got the National Guard down on the border. Of course, they don't have any weapons. They're not supposed to do much of anything. But certainly we're all going to feel better knowing the National Guard's down there, unarmed, unable to intercept anybody, but... it looks to me like this is all for show. It's all symbolism over substance. What's your
thought? It was a show for a while in August, Dr. Stan, but as you know, I fly the border. I am a pilot. I have an airplane, and American Border Patrol has an airplane, and I go up in the air and fly the border. As a matter of fact, I do it and send live television images out over the Internet. I did that this afternoon, and I was up flying the border and talking to the audience on the Internet saying, hey, where is the National Guard? And as I flew along the border, we showed images. There were no National Guard on the border. They're not there, Dr. Stan. I'm sorry to tell you, but that's a myth.
Well, now, were they there for a time, or did they just...
Yes, they were there for about 2 weeks.
In other words, they're simply lying to the American people again.
Again, yes. And we prove it all the time. They are lying to you.
Well, we always feel so much better because they're doing something. And now they said they're going to build a 700-mile fence along the 2,000-mile border, and that makes us all feel so much more secure.
Well... the audience can judge for itself. Do you trust the people who lie to you?
No, I really don't, Glenn. I'm saying this to someone with tongue in cheek. I don't think they're ever going to build a fence. I don't think they have any intention of building the fence. I think it was all to try to get votes for the coming election.
No question about it. They won't build. They will tear down. They will go out and tear down what is there. And they will lie to you about it. And we have a AmericanBorderPatrol.com. We send live video out over the Internet. And I narrated it today for an hour. And I said, look down. Look, you can see it on your computer screen. Do you see anybody working on the border? Do you see anybody down there? There was nobody down there. There was no one down there, Dr. Stan. Yes, they were in late August, early September. They were there. They're no longer there.
Well, that's one reason I wanted to call you to find out what's really going on down there at the present time. Now, of course, we were told that because of the National Guard was down there, there'd been a dramatic decrease in the number of people apprehended. That doesn't mean there'd been a decrease in the number of people coming across the border. Maybe they just weren't trying to get them. But do you think we've cut down at all on the number of people coming across the border, or at least temporarily until we get through the elections?
Well, there was a slight decrease between September and October. It was statistically insignificant. Dr. Stan, you were trained as a scientist, and you understand what I mean when I say that. It was statistically insignificant. It was part of a random fluctuation. A random fluctuation around an average or mean, which is unacceptable. 1,100,000 versus 1,020,000.
Now, is that over a period of a month, 3 months, or 6 months?
Yes, 1 month.
1,000,000 in a month?
Oh, no, over a period of a year.
Okay, fine.
Projected for that year. So a small decrease in the annual rate of invasion of our country, when the rate is so high as to be unacceptable. And one of the reasons they use this number is that they don't want to be measured. I don't want to get too arcane here, but there's an old axiom: if you can't measure it, you can't improve it. And they don't want to be measured. They don't want the American people to know how many people are actually invading our country every day.
Well, of course, was this million point six figure that you used, is that the total number, or is that the number apprehended?
That's the number apprehended.
What is it, probably four times that many, or three times that many? Do we have any idea?
It's hard to know. I kind of think that it's probably two times that number. So in other words, they catch probably one in... I'm right down there, right? I think they catch one in two, which is a big difference between from that, what I'm saying. But that's still 1.6 million people, right, crossing our border every year.
Well, of course, some of those are people who have come from other countries, and if they come from other countries, I think either other than Mexico or maybe El Salvador, aren't they actually part of the catch and release program and promptly released?
Yeah, they're called other than Mexicans. They're supposed to hold those people, but once again, they're not. They're releasing them. The one thing you know about the issue of illegal immigration, when the government's lips are moving, they are lying.
Well, certainly they've deceived the American people, but don't you really think, Glenn, that they do enough want the American people to know the truth, and that is they don't really want to stop the illegal immigration because they really want it to become normal migration. They really want, of course, to merge our country with Mexico and with Canada and build this North American community and destroy American sovereignty, but they can't tell the American people that.
There is no question about that. We have developed technology that is very, very good. We have infrared cameras that see at night that are better than anything the Border Patrol has. And even though we're a small organization, we can show this and demonstrate it. Let me give you an example of what they just did to us. About a month ago, we saw a spot north of the border that was being used by the National Guard. No, 2 months ago, by the National Guard. I guess I flew over it and I said, look, there's the National Guard looking down from a hilltop. And about a week later, they were gone. So we said, let's go up to that hilltop with our powerful camera. And we went up, and in about an hour, we spotted these people coming north of the border that passed all of the cameras that the Border Patrol had. So So we called the Border Patrol and we said, here they are. They're right here. So they tried to find them, and they, one group of Border Patrol, they went right past them. And the other guy had a difficult time. So about a week ago, we went to the same spot, but this time we had an eye-safe laser. It wouldn't hurt anyone. And we said, all right, we spotted this group. Now, here they are. We're going to light them up with a laser. They didn't like that, Dr. Stan. They came up and arrested us and threw one of the guys, my chief technician, into jail.
Well, why was that?
It turns out he had a parking ticket 12 years ago in Phoenix that he hadn't paid and forgot about. And somehow they found out about it. Nobody can figure out how. He didn't even know. And they threw him in jail. And then we have a friend who is in the Border Patrol. And when this man who came up and arrested him, who was a Border Patrol supervisor, got back to the station, he went into the office where the supervisors were, and they had a high five. They said, we got American Border Patrol. Hey, Ray! Well, the magistrate, the next morning, they took my man, threw him in jail. And the next morning, the magistrate there looked at the record and let him go on his own recognizance. He said, this is outrageous. So they arrested my man. And the word is, they're out to get us any way they can.
Well, of course, but Glenn, you're standing in the way of a very, very powerful organization that is intent upon destroying the sovereignty of America. And anybody who gets in their way, they'll run over just like a steamroller. And, you know, the fact that they would arrest him, you know, on a 12-year-old parking ticket, can't he just pay the parking ticket and let the thing go?
He would have done. They have no right to do this.
In fact, is a 12-year-old parking ticket still, valid?
Well, I don't even think so. I talked to a judge, and he said, you don't arrest someone for that. You don't throw him in handcuffs in the back of a Border Patrol vehicle.
In fact, what is the Border Patrol doing arresting somebody? They're supposed to be concerned with immigration, not with parking ticket violations. Certainly, the police officer...
They're out after anybody who will interfere with the invasion of our country.
In other words, the whole idea is to let the immigrants come in and, of course, flood into our country, the idea of changing our nation, making us a multilingual,
right,
multicultural society.
Diversity and the end of the United States.
That's exactly what it's about, and the traitors, of course, are not over in Iraq. They're right here in Washington, D.C. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest, of course, is Glenn Spencer. And, of course, Glenn was telling us about when they actually had a special type of laser that certainly would, you could beam on people. It wouldn't hurt their eyes if they looked into it, but it would help the Border Patrol identify a large number of immigrants coming into our country, invading our country. And instead of going after the immigrants, they went after Glenn and the man who was working with him. And did they ever try to get the immigrants that you were pointing out to them?
No.
And, of course, they arrested this man because he had a 12-year-old parking here.
They ran into trouble because they're going to get into trouble because we had two reporters from the Houston Chronicle with us. And the supervisor who did this didn't even know it. And so they're going to be in serious trouble because it was called selective prosecution. They had no reason to stop my assistant, my man. They had no reason to ask him for his driver's license. They had no reason to investigate. There was no probable cause. he hadn't done anything wrong. And I've had judges tell me, this is an outrage. And when they went back, right, and went back to the headquarters of the Border Patrol and had a high five that they had gotten American Border Patrol, this was an outrage.
But don't many of the Border Patrol agents really support what you're doing. It's simply the supervisors and the people in the upper echelon.
They sent a supervisor up there who he knew who we were. I have been forced out of the sky in my airplane because they threatened to bring in an interceptor. I have been held at gunpoint at the airport. They hate what we're doing because we're the only organization in the United... Can you believe this? We're the only organization in the entire United States of America who is looking and watching what the Border Patrol really does.
Well, Chris, this is why we get glad to get you onto our program. You keep us abreast of what's going on down there. What about the Minutemen? Are they just simply coming and going, and are they accomplishing anything?
The Minutemen, in my judgment, and this was almost 2 years ago, what a fantastic job they did. And Jim Gilchrist, who came out here, a former Marine, certified public accountant, what a great job. And he is still working very hard in California and all around the country. And he just wrote a book with Jim Corsi about the Minutemen.
Well, we actually carry the book called Minutemen.
Yes. And James, Jerome Corsi is a graduate from a great university in the East. And I met him. We went down in Texas on 9/11. And Corsi and I and Congressman Smith from Iowa, we stood there and had our pictures taken. And, yes, they have done a great job.
All right, great. Well, I think that, of course, they're not there all the time, and you are there all the time, and that gives you an advantage over the rest of them. And of course, with a plane, you can cover a fairly good size of the border, and I just hope that they do not send one of the interceptors up there one of these times. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Glenn Spencer, and if you're out in the listening audience, you have a question or our comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Glenn, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your website, how they can actually see the live videos that you sent out on a regular basis. And how many people are you actually getting onto your webpage every day? Do you have any idea?
Well, now, American Border Patrol is a non-profit corporation, and we have a website called AmericanBorderPatrol.com, but I have another one that I finance myself called American Patrol, and that one is we call the Take No Prisoners. That is a slash and burn, it's a tough website. That has almost 18 million visitors. We'll pass that pretty soon. And I think it's about 20 to 25,000 people a day come to that website.
Well, I think that's great, Glenn. And certainly that's AmericanPatrol.com. Is that AmericanPatrol.com?
And we feature, American Patrol features a lot of what American Border Patrol does. American Border Patrol is a non-profit organization. We rely on donations from individuals, which are, by the way, coming in rather well, Dr. Stan.
I'm so glad for that, and certainly we think the Glenn's efforts are very, very important, and he is really our major source of information, because you're not going to get the truth from the media, and you're not going to get the truth from the government, and you're sure not going to get the truth from the Border Patrol. Not that the average Border Patrol officer isn't trying to do his best, but the supervisors, the people in key positions there, have been promoted not because they want to stop the invasion, but because they'll go along with the agenda and sell out and betray America.
There is
no
question about that. We've said that for years and years and years, And now I'm down here, I live here, I watch it, I observe it, we have a listening post, and there is no question about that.
Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295 if you have a question for Glenn and about what's really going on down there at the border at the present time. And you know, the thing is that most people do not understand the catch-and-release program. Most people do not understand that if you're a Mexican, they take you back across the border if they catch you, and then so you can try again, you know. If first you don't succeed, try and try and try and try again until you get into the country. And, of course, a recent poll, somebody, Jay Leno's remark, you know, they had a recent poll in Mexico about whether the Mexicans wanted to come to America, and 70% of them said they wanted to, but the other 30%, they were already up here in the States.
Did he really say that?
Yeah.
Congratulations. There's a lot of truth in that.
Well, of course, there is a lot of truth in it. That's why it's so funny and really so tragic. And I don't blame the Mexicans for wanting a better life. And a lot of them are hardworking people. But the thing is that they will destroy this country. And that's exactly what the people in Washington, D.C. want, because they do not believe in America. They do not believe in American sovereignty. They are internationalists. They're dedicated, of course, to building a North American community, and then, of course, merging it with the ASEAN nations, which are already under China's control, building up a ASEAN union, an Asian union, with the European Union and their unions all throughout the world being created, financed, of course, by people of great wealth, who believe in this idea of the new order of the ages, the Novus Ordo Seclorum, of this ancient quest that is about to be fulfilled. Well, you know, Glenn, certainly, do you have any help down there? Do people come down and actually lend a hand? Are you pretty much a one-man operation?
Well, yes, we do have help. You know, we started out 5 years ago using volunteers, and people came down. But this is such a complicated problem. The Minutemen found this out. You know, you come down and sit in a lawn chair with field glasses, and you don't see anything. You know, you sit here for 2 weeks and not see anything. It's a very difficult problem. But, so we found this out, and we're using technology, special technology, and then we get special people. I have a fellow who is a senior captain with a major airline who comes down, Dr. Stan, and flies our airplane for us and helps us document what goes on.
And, of course, you see the vans of immigrants coming across the desert there trying to get into the country?
Oh, yes. But it's very complicated. And also, just recently, and I have to be very careful how I say it.
Well, don't say it right now. We're going to have to take a quick break, and we'll get that when we get back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Glenn Spencer from American Patrol, American Border Patrol, and we were simply talking about what he does down there, the people he has coming down to help him, and pick up the story there, Glenn.
Well, you know, when we went down with the Minutemen to Laredo, Texas on 9/11, on 9/10, we were invited down to the Border Patrol headquarters at Laredo, and we sat in a big room and talked about what we were about to do, and Jerome Corsi was there, and Jim Gilchrist, and a lot of other great people. And we learned that in the major drug smuggling corridor across Nuevo Laredo, this has been in the news a lot, that's in Mexico, the murder capital of the border, the Border Patrol, I said, you know, we have a night vision camera capability, and I'm the pilot, and we'll fly this. And they said, you know what they told me? In Laredo, Texas, the major smuggling corridor, the Border Patrol has no night vision capability from the air. Nothing. And so, but the weather was really bad. If anybody has been following the weather in South Texas, for about a month, they had storms and storms. So we had to get out of there. I barely got out of there. Then it cleared up, and I personally got a call from a supervising agent at the Laredo, Texas Border Patrol Station. And he said, you know what, you have this night capability. Could you come down if the weather clears and help us? And I have his name and telephone number. And I said, we'll be back as soon as we can. So he called me again, and he said, can you come and help us? And I said, okay, we'll come down. So, and it's not cheap for us to do this. So we went to Laredo, Texas, flew all the way down there. And we got there and we called him. And he said, oh, I'm sorry. They've reassigned me elsewhere. And I can't help you. Here's my supervisor's number. He would not even talk to us. They would have nothing to do with us. Apparently they found out that this agent had asked for our help. But I'm going to say this, and I'm going to do it very carefully.
Hold just a moment, Glenn. We're going to bring our other stations back on board here, and I want them to hear the story you're about to tell. So hang on with us here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Glenn is simply telling us he was contacted by the Border Patrol in Laredo, Texas, and this agent had asked him if he'd come down because they don't have any night vision equipment, and Glenn does, has sophisticated equipment. In other words, the federal government has got billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars, but of course they don't have enough money for night equipment. Therefore,
from the air.
Of course, when he gets down to Laredo, why somebody has reassigned this agent who wants Glenn to come down, and the border patrol, the supervisor, will not have anything to do with him. In other words, they don't really want, of course, to catch the people involved in drug smuggling come in from Mexico. And the last thing they wanted was for Glenn to come down with his night vision equipment and help him. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely. And the reason this fellow had called us is because we put these images up on the internet, and we showed, I was flying the airplane. We spot people from the air at night and guide the Border Patrol into, oh, they're over here. This camera cost us $65,000. It's the most powerful camera available for this work. And it's wonderful. And this agent, this supervising agent, had seen this on the internet. And then when we got down there, he was gone. He had been reassigned. And the other ones, they wouldn't talk to us. But I was about to say, but the word got out, and I don't know how, but to a group of private citizens in Texas, and I have to be careful with what I say here, but then we were down in Laredo, and they said, come on over and talk to us, and we went out and flew a night mission with them, with our new laser and our all of this, and they then put us in touch, Dr. Stan, with people that represent the largest ranches in Texas. As a matter of fact, on the planet. And we're now working with them. And you're going to hear from us in the near future, working in Texas.
Well, I hope so, and I hope that they will help you and support your effort to get the information out. And it's finally important that the people across America understand that whether in Washington, D.C., the president says he's against amnesty, all he wants is for the people to be able to stay here and become citizens. He's not being forthright. When the president says he's against, Spanish being spoken, he wants English to be the official language of our country, and yet you go to the president's website and it's all available in Spanish and in English, you know he's not being forthright. When the president tells us he's against torture and you know he's authorizing torture, he's not being forthright. What we need, of course, are people who will tell the truth and stand by it. For as Andrew Jackson said, one man with courage is a majority. But if you have a man, of course, who does not tell the truth, why, no man's life or property is safe. And what we're really talking about is the destruction of the United States of America. This is the frightening thing. We are talking about, while our boys are overseas fighting for our freedom, losing our freedom here at home, because if they merge us with Mexico, we'll soon have the same living standards and freedom enjoyed by the Mexican peasants. So how are we going to get the word out, Glenn?
Dr. Stan, and you know, here we have the House of Representatives stood up for the president. They passed a border enforcement bill only. Of course the president's going to try to water it down. But he was forced to sign this bill, which was H.R. 6061, the border fence bill. Yes, they're going to try to kill it, even though the president signed it. But I will tell you something. The same forces, the same people, like the people who are listening to you, Dr. Stan, who forced the president to sign this, are going to force him to build it. And if they don't, you know, today, or was it earlier yesterday, Representative Duncan Hunter, a member of the House of Representatives from California, the man who was the most responsible for building that 14-mile fence in San Diego, and then sponsoring the 700-mile extension, he said he's going to run for president. It shocked everyone.
Are you for or against that?
I'm for him.
All right, fine. Well, I've always sort of liked Duncan Hunter. I always thought he was an honest man.
He's head of the House Armed Services Committee. I worked with Duncan Hunter 10 years ago when he was trying to get that wall built, the fence built in California. And I held a big rally. This next March, it'll be 10 years ago, called Good Fences Make Good Neighbors. And he was the congressman behind it. And he has now announced that he is going to run for president, and the border is going to be the issue.
Well, of course, he's got to cover a lot of issues, but that's a very important issue. I think it's one of the most
important issues
in most America.
Many, many issues, of course. But he's saying we're going to give the American people a choice.
Well, of course, the establishment will go do everything they can to destroy him if he tries to run, but that's all right. That we've got more and more people than ever before who listen to alternative radio, who are up on the Internet, that are getting videos. In fact, I will tell you, the videos that are up there on YouTube and on Google are having a tremendous impact
yes.
upon the thought of the American people. And we're seeing things that have been suppressed for years, and suddenly... you go up on the Internet and see them, and it really is an amazing phenomenon. I don't know how long they can allow the American people to get the truth before maybe the American people are going to understand that there really is an invisible government that has an entirely different worldview and hates those of us who cherish freedom.
Well, you're absolutely right, Dr. Stan. There is this movement, and Dennis Hastert, who is here today, in Arizona, with Randy Graff supporting him for Congress, even though the Republican Party run by the president won't give him a dime. Duncan Hunter was out last week. Dennis Tassett was out today. And Randy Graff has been a champion for the controlling of our borders. But the president's control of the party, he won't give him any money. He won't support him. He had, we had a congressman here who was a out of the closet homosexual, open borders advocate that the president fought to keep in office 2 years ago. And he, the president's father, recorded a radio message for Colby, was his name. Elect Colby. Elect this man. open borders, homosexual, anti-family, anti-American person who they supported.
Well, Chris, now, did he win or not?
Well, Colby won. He was a Republican. He won last time. This time, he has retired because he knew that the tide was running against him.
All right. Now, is that the seat that this other gentleman's running
so,
for?
So now, Mr. Graf, who won the Republican primary to replace Mr. Colby, now the president won't even give him the time of day.
Well,
you have to understand, there is a civil war going on inside of the Republican Party right now. So today, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Dennis Hastert, came out to Tucson to speak up for Randy Graf, who was nominated and elected by the Republicans to go up against his opposition. And the president's party, he runs the Republican Party, won't give him a nickel.
Well, I tell you what, I'm proud of Hastert, Dennis Hastert. For
he was here today.
I'm glad for that, and I appreciate the fact that that Duncan Hunter really came out
for
him.
And Duncan Hunter was here last Friday.
All right, and so I think it's so vitally important that we get behind the good people, because you're probably not going to be living in that congressional district, but these people need all the help that they can possibly get.
Absolutely.
All right, fine. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. What you really have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, if you're a Republican, is that the current Republican leadership, most of them are pro-homosexual, are anti-family, are anti-life.
Absolutely.
They play this little game, oh, we're pro-life and we're pro-morality, and those terrible Democrats over there are pro-death and they're pro-gay and pro-immorality, and it's all a game. And, of course, you know, when the smoke finally cleared after this holy debacle, we find out that there are all sorts of homosexuals working in key positions. Certainly the closest advisor to in the Defense Department, Donald Rumsfeld, is a homosexual who clears all military appointments. You can't get an appointment in the U.S. military today at a key position or get promoted, you know, if you are considered to be anti-gay, because the man who screens you is himself gay.
That's correct. And this is what has happened to our country so quickly.
Well, there's no incidents in all history where a nation turns against God, God's law, where that nation has survived. And everybody's looking at this from a political point of view. I think we ought to start looking at it from a spiritual point of view and understand the spiritual implications of what's going on. Once again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. If you have a question or comment for Glenn Spencer, who is here on the front lines of this battle. And once again, his website is AmericanPatrol.com or AmericanBorderPatrol.com. Which is to be the best one to go to?
Well, I would say AmericanPatrol.com. And it's updated more often. I finance that myself. I pay for that. I have a webmaster in California. I do the features every day. He is a great old sailor who lives in a little apartment overlooking the San Pedro Bay. And with his cats, he maintains this website and has for 10 years.
Well, I think you're lucky to have somebody like that that you can trust, who really believes in America. And the trouble is, we've got an awful lot of people who believe in America, but they don't really believe that we could lose this country. And I will tell you, of course, that, you know, the country can be lost, and freedom once lost will never be regained in our lifetime.
And it's the dishonesty. It's the manipulation. It's the propaganda, it's the disinformation, it's the lies that we have to fight against. But I sense that we're coming back. We're with Dennis Hastert and so forth. And even, you know, we have Senator Frist, as you know, is a physician. And he turned to our side. One of the reasons is, I have on my board of directors a man, I don't even want to mention his name, who is friends with Senator Frist, and we were able to get petitions into him, hundreds of thousands of them that we gathered through a direct mail campaign. And at the end, you know, Senator Frist is retired now, but at the end, he pushed through this fence bill through the Senate, and he was on our side. And I thank God that he was there. Hello?
I'm glad that the bill got through the Senate. I'm not sure it's ever going to get built, because I think they'll put every possible barrier in the way, because the leaders in Washington, D.C. do not want to stop illegal immigration. They want a multicultural, multilingual society so they can play one group against the other. They want to lower the living standards of the American people, and of course all the jobs, people coming in and taking jobs at $8 to $10 an hour, and of course you can't live on $8 to $10 an hour and support a family, you know, unless your wife is working, and even then you're going to have a hard time doing it with simply one job. But I believe that the living standards are going to go down. I believe the salaries are going to go down. And of course, this is exactly what the people in positions of power who are manipulating this whole thing want. And that's why immigration is so important. And what's even more incredible is they actually now have made agreements now where you come into this country illegally and you work here illegally, you'll be able to get your Social Security. What sort of madness is that?
Well, it is totally consistent with the attitude and the philosophy of those who have fought to keep our borders open. They want to destroy the United States. And as Peter Brimelow said in his book, Alien Nation, and Peter, who is the major writer for Forbes magazine, Peter said there is a sense in opening his book, this is a direct quote, he says there is a sense in which America's immigration policy is Hitler's posthumous revenge. And in a sense what he's saying is Hitler's laughing at us. So you like the great super race. So you opened your borders to everyone to make sure that this never happened. And now you see that you have destroyed your culture, your race, and your nation.
And I really fear this is exactly what we're doing. I think we are systematically destroying our nation. Well, our guest this evening has been Glenn Spencer, www.AmericanBorderPatrol or American Patrol. And let me recommend you go to those websites. You'll get a great deal of information there. And we'll be back in just about a couple of minutes here to wrap up the program. But, Glenn, do you have one parting thought for our listeners before we go to our next break?
Well, it's only this. Keep listening to Dr. Stan. Believe in what he's saying and take action, because someone once said, don't question whether a small group of dedicated, competent people can change the course of history. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has.
In fact, there is a dedicated group of people trying to change history, but they're on the other side. What we need are people who believe in America, who want to preserve it. You hang on there for just a moment, Glenn, and we'll be right back with you here. We've got Roger calling from Allentown. Roger, do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, thank you. Glenn, I'd like to ask if you could add anything to cover what I think is this particular aspect of the lie, which is really just the pseudo-intellectual cover I suspect, is, you know, the claim that business is demanding these cheap workers when I think it's only the...
All right, well, let's get Glenn's response to that. How do you respond to that, this idea that, that business is really behind this encouraging illegal immigration because they want cheap labor? Is that accurate?
Well, Dr. Stan, I have to have a degree in economics, and I will tell you that it's good dollars forcing bad dollars out. As a businessman, I have to optimize. If my competition is hiring illegal aliens, and I don't, I go out of business. So I'm forced to do it. It isn't that I'm greedy. It's just that I want to survive. And if this environment, this economic environment, forces me to do it, I must do it.
All right, I think that's a very valid thing, and I think this is why a lot of businesses are hiring the illegal immigrants. Anything else, Roger?
So wouldn't a lot of these same like contractors and such be happy that their fellows were getting prosecuted so that they didn't have to compete that way?
That is correct.
But, of course, they're not going to get prosecuted, Roger, because the leaders of our country do not want to stop the illegal immigration. And so once in a while, they'll slap somebody on the wrist. But it's all for show business, like the National Guard on the border. Of course, the National Guard were only there for a short period of time, like stopping the catch-and-release program. But they may have done it for a short period of time, but they have no intention of stopping illegal immigration.
There's no evidence. And we're down here. We are American Border Patrol. We're the only organization of our kind in the United States that actually go down and show you what's going on.
And, of course, you can, of course, get onto those websites. You can actually see the pictures as Glenn has taken them live from his airplane and getting it by the miracle of electronics right into your own home. Glenn
That's
Spencer,
correct.
Thank you so very much for being with us.
God bless.
And Roger, thank you so much for calling. Good night to both of you. And this is Dr. Stan here. And, of course, this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. We certainly will look forward to hearing from you by calling us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And we do hope to hear from you. And we'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and we do actually carry several items. We actually carry the book Minuteman by Dr. Jerome Corsi and Jim Gilchrist, an excellent book. We have another book called Fighting Immigration Anarchy, which we suggest very strongly that you get. We have a 4-tape set on immigration. We carry a video put together by Glenn Spencer, who you heard tonight, talking about the conquest of Aztlan. And there really is a plan on the part of the radicals and the communists who are being funded by the Ford Foundation and even by your own government. And we're talking about La Raza and Maldave and LULAC and all of these organizations, racist organizations being funded by the Ford Foundation. Keep that in mind, the Ford Foundation. And, of course, they simply want to take back by force California, New Mexico, Arizona, part of Colorado, Texas, and just merge it into Mexico, which doesn't make any sense. But this is, of course, what they're advocating. They're even telling people to pick out which house you want to move into when we send the gringos out. Now, I do not believe it's going to happen. I think they're simply going to take their homes away from us by other means, but they're using the Mexicans coming up here, telling them that they've been exploited for years by the gringos, and now is the chance to get even. And they're preaching racial hatred funded by the Ford Foundation. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we got a real problem. So, again, the book, The Minutemen, the book Fighting Immigration Anarchy, the DVD, The Conquest of Aztlan, and then, of course, the 4-tape set on immigration. You need to have the information. You need to see how it's going. And then we put together another 4-tape set of really interviews with Dr. Corsi and the others. And, of course, it's called North American Community, The Demise of National Sovereignty, a great new 4-tape set. of the North American community, the demise of national sovereignty, and those, of course, are interviews with Dr. Corsi. You need to be on the cutting edge of what's going on today. Things are moving at a tremendous clip. Do you really care about freedom? Do you think it can be maintained? Remember, the only way to maintain freedom is for people to be involved. And if you think you're going to have the benefits of freedom without being involved, why, you're sadly mistaken, as the people of places like Cuba and Nicaragua and Communist China found out. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the time we need to remind our listeners Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, or subscribing to the newsletter, or helping in whatever way you can, because quite frankly, we need your help to maintain the base of almost 60 different outlets we have every week in the name of Internet. We have 4 different Internets and 3 different satellites and several different shortwave frequencies and then a number of radio stations all across America. But we do need your help. So if you believe, as I do, we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization, give us a call. 1-800-544-8927. Those of you who would like to know more about the influenza vaccine they're pushing right now, you should call and get the video that was shot at our meeting last year by Dr. Ayoub, A-Y-O-U-B, on influenza vaccine. You need to get it. You need to watch it. Certainly, we carry an excellent DVD by Dr. Russell Blaylock on nutrition and behavior. And many people who are drug addicts and even into alcoholism or having behavioral abnormalities, much of this can really be helpful with proper nutrition. Things you're never going to hear about. You have to understand how they're poisoning our children and destroying the minds of our children and lowering the IQs of our children with fluoride. You need to get our talk on the hidden agenda, and you need, of course, to get the syllabus that goes with that. That's the hidden agenda. And the syllabus goes with it. They're destroying the minds of our children with the thimerosal in the influenza vaccine. They know what they're doing. They just don't want you to know. We're dealing with organized evil. And so, this is Dr. Stan asking you to pray for America. Pray for revival, because this is truly a spiritual battle. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Till tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.